Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who routinely raises the IQ of certainly this host, and I think probably of the content of the program, is our first guest. His name is Bill Walton, a former master of the universe on Wall Street, and now one of the leaders of the conservative movement here in Washington, D.C. He is the host of his own podcast television program, The Bill Walton Show, and a great asset and contributor to this program. We're always delighted to have him with us. Bill, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, Frank.
I wanted to take stock with you, Bill, as we will with Gordon Chang in a moment about China, but on other aspects of the G7 summit meeting over the weekend and its agenda, talk a little bit about this global tax minimum initiative that was approved by those seven leaders.
Well, the goal here, Janet Yellen came away from the G7 meeting with the finance ministers, where they agreed to, in principle, to the idea of having a 15% minimum tax on corporations throughout the world. And this does what all the progressive elites hope, is to eliminate tax competition, where companies like, I mentioned this last week, Ireland and Hungary have low taxes and therefore attract a lot of investment. The G7 countries don't want that. They want high taxes on corporations throughout the world. But what this really is, though, is an attempt to tax the large tech companies, because if you look at the definition of what they're taxing, in return for agreeing to a 15% minimum tax, Yellen gave away tax revenue to countries of origin. That is where for 100 years, we've had a regime where tech companies are taxed only where they're headquartered. Now this would throw some money to the companies or to the countries where the companies have operations. And they've defined it as a tax on companies with a profit margin greater than 10%. And they'd kick back 20% to those countries where the companies have locations. Well, if you analyze the margins on big companies, it's almost exclusively the large tech companies that have margins that are 10% or greater. And so it's a tax aimed at tech companies. And what they're hopeful of doing is creating enough revenue from this other 15% global tax one that would mitigate the harm they're going to do with higher rates here in the United States.
This sounds problematic in a number of regards, but particularly in so far.
The good news is that it probably will never happen, because there are just so many conflicting interests in this area. I don't see it. I don't see, particularly during this administration, I don't think these people are competent enough to negotiate something like this.
Well, the piece that I particularly worry about, Bill, which is presumably kind of a knock-on effect if they get their way on this thing, is that they will begin doing global taxing as well as setting standards and the like. And that's hopefully going to be a bridge too far at the moment as well. Let me turn to another agenda item that Joe Biden was particularly pleased with, I think, and that is probably also not going to come to pass, but do give us a sense of this $40 trillion commitment to build back better globally.
Build back better globally. It's great. You're trying to pick something up that's catchy, like the Belt and Road Initiative that the Chinese have been doing for years. And, you know, in the first place, $40 trillion, it's supposed to come from the G7 countries and private interest. And that's going to have as much chance of being collected as the NATO dues have been collected. The money's not going to be there for this. But again, it's an attempt to declare something as infrastructure that is not really infrastructure. What this is focused on is gender equity and equality, health security, technology, and of course, that favorite, the climate. And, you know, I just on a personal note, when I ran a public company, we had to be very careful about making, quote, forward-looking statements that shareholders could come back later on and sue you for not meeting your proclamations. Well, I think we need a forward-looking statement for our world leaders. They promised to cut collective greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 in half. And of course, that's 9 years from now. And the it's a fantasy. And so this $40 trillion is also lumped in with a lot of other initiatives. But the atmospherics are interesting, Frank, because you know, Joe Biden gave the press release remarks, but then when it came to Q&A, Jill Biden was the one who was answering the questions, and Joe didn't answer any. And then you've got all these awkward photo ops where Boris Johnson's trying to bang elbows with Merkel, and of course Merkel refuses to do it. I mean, it was the human comedy on display the UK this weekend was very entertaining.
You know, Tucker Carlson had been mocking Jill Biden as the person who's getting prepared for this summit and the role that she was going to play in it. But I had missed the the substitution on the Q&A, but doesn't that tell you everything you need to know about the competency of this president to move off of script and teleprompter? Exhibit A, indeed. Hey, Bill, one other thing, just quickly, talking about these forward promises, we were told this week that the Chinese Communist Party is going to be net carbon neutral by 2060. Now, that's a long time from now. But is there any evidence, and I know that the G7 were, you know, putting the tombstone marker in place on the coal industry. But is there any evidence that the Chinese are actually weaning themselves off of coal at the moment?
None whatsoever. In fact, they had a communique internally in China that they were not going to be requesting, they're not going to be demanding that the coal producers even try to hit emission standards. And they've given themselves a break because they think they need to maintain economic growth. And all this emission requirements would cut every country's economic growth. And the Chinese care a lot about keeping those plates spinning because, as you and I know, if the Chinese Communist Party doesn't keep the economy growing, their grip on power is weakened dramatically.
And their indifference to not only the environment for their own people, but for that matter, those downwind is pretty spectacular as well,
yeah,
including California being among those that are downwind from the Chinese coal emission.
And while we're banning plastic straws, go take a look at what's coming out of the rivers in China. It's just disgusting.
Yeah. And polluting the oceans as well. I think it's 30% of all of the world's plastic in the oceans is just emanating from the one country of China. Bill, we have to leave it at that. A lot of things to digest. I appreciate your help in doing so, as always, and for your leadership at the Council for National Policy, among other places, as we wrestle with how best to contend with these various challenges, foreign and domestic. And salute your leadership and look forward to talking further about it next week. Thank you for your time today, my friend. Next up, Charles Sam Faddis joins us. We'll talk about Eric Swalwell, why he's a threat to our national security, what we should do about it right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back and joined by one of our regulars here, I'm very pleased to say, at Secure Freedom Radio. He is Charles Sam Faddis, a Renaissance man who has served his country in a number of capacities, including in the uniform of the United States Army, and without a uniform, as an undercover clandestine services officer in the Central Intelligence Agency. He's been an assistant attorney general out in Washington State, a candidate for Congress in Maryland. He is the driving force behind an indispensable online resource. It's called And Magazine. He's also the author of, among other things, Beyond Repair, the decline and fall of the Central Intelligence Agency. Welcome back, Sam. It's good to have you with us as always.
Great to be here, Frank. Thank you.
Well, a number of things I want to talk to you about, particularly having to do with China. We'll be talking more about this in the coming segment with Gordon Chang, but I did want to just calibrate on a couple of things with you, drawing particularly on your experience with spying and the tradecraft of it. We have recently been treated to a new controversy involving a congressman by the name of Eric Swalwell of California, who, of course, famously slept with a Chinese spy and took campaign contributions from her. He's now gone after in what seems to be a pretty naked act of political warfare, a fellow congressman, Mo Brooks, who is running for the United States Senate. But it's called to mind afresh what on earth is going on with his continued service on the House Intelligence Committee. And I wanted to get your sense of it as a guy who, again, formerly handled spies for our country. What are the chances that Eric Swalwell, having been so deeply compromised by the Chinese Communist Party and its operatives, would not still be subject to exploitation by them, and therefore a real national security threat on a committee that oversees our most sensitive national secret?
Well, you know, based on the totality of the information that I've seen, I think we have a very good chance that Swalwell was compromised. And the way the craft works, we do not in fact know that Swalwell is not now actively working as a spy for the Chinese. In fact, from a counterintelligence perspective, any prudent counterintelligence officer looking at this situation and investigating it would start with the assumption that until proven otherwise, we need to remove this guy from access to any sensitive information, complete this investigation. In other words, until he is cleared, he's going off here in a penalty box, if you will, at a minimum. I mean, the way this works is if you develop someone, which is spy lingo for sort of schmoozing them, meet them on socially, begin to, you know, hand them money, other favors, whether that's sex, cash, access to things, and you begin to sort of pull them down the rabbit hole into becoming a Chinese spy. When you get them fully recruited, again, a spy term, when they agree formally to go to work for the CCP, at that point, all social contact with them ceases. You do not continue to meet with the guy who has access to the launch codes in the Kremlin, to use the usual grade B movie act thing. In public, at that point, it becomes a fully clandestine contact. By definition, it is invisible. So the fact that the original paramour or whatever here has moved on and gone away tells us nothing. That in fact, would be completely consistent with the fact that he is a Chinese spy. He's being met. He's being handled. He's communicating electronically. It depends on the case. We don't know any of that. We haven't proven that that's not the case. So you should be working from the assumption that, yeah, this guy formally takes orders from the CCP, given everything we know, until we get to the bottom of it.
Now, you said something that's very important. I don't know if we have certitude about this. I think it's not an unreasonable assumption, though, namely that Eric Swalwell, at some point, knowingly threw in with the Chinese Communist Party to provide, you know, information to one of its operatives. Again, walk us through why that's a reasonable expectation under these circumstances, given what we know.
Well, I mean, the purpose of the recruitment is obviously to get him to do things for the Chinese. I mean, he can hand them information, but it isn't. Cases of this type involving an individual with his access and his level of influence, which is mind-blowing given who we're talking about, but the fact is he does have influence. Obviously, he would be recruited not simply to provide information, but to take specific actions in furtherance of CCP objective. And based on what I know about the case, you have all of the indicators here. Look, if this guy was sitting on a desk at CIA or NSA or anyplace else, they would have walked him out of the building, taken away his badge. He might not yet be terminated, but he certainly would have been removed from access to everything. And they would be busy taking a deep dive into every little minute detail of his contact with the Chinese until proven otherwise at this point. Yet this guy's, you know, well, I mean, that's not, nothing like that is happening right
now. No, to the contrary, he is with Nancy Pelosi's strong support, still a member of the House Intelligence Committee with access to, again, many, if not virtually all, of the most sensitive secrets of our country. It is a scandal, and I believe it must be brought to an end. And we will be talking more about that and working to that end. Sam, let me turn to another topic, one that you've addressed just the other day at andmagazine.com. And let me preface it by saying that you're a member of the Committee on the Present Danger China, for which I'm very grateful. You are joined in that regard by another of our founding members, Kyle Bass. And Kyle has raised a warning now on several different occasions about Chinese acquisitions of real estate that has very significant national security implications. In one case, as we've talked about on the program now several times, we've seen them get access to 200 square miles of Texas, and not just any old piece of Texas, but down by the border and near an Air Force base. Kyle Bass helpfully engaged with the Senate and legislature of Texas and got them to at least adopt legislation that would limit some of the possible dangers of this, namely unplugging this so-called Morningstar Ranch and the Blue Hills, I think it was called, wind farm that was supposed to be built there from the Texas grid. But this raises another question, and you've talked about real estate that China has been acquiring in the Bahama Islands, 100 or so miles off our coast, and immediately adjacent to another very sensitive U.S. military asset. Talk a little bit about Bird K and more generally what's been going on with the Chinese, their Belt and Road Initiative and so on in the Bahama Islands and its implications for our national security.
Well, the Chinese have been for a number of years, they've had a number of different initiatives underway in the Bahamas, all of which ought to concern us on a whole variety of levels. Some of this is port development. Some of this is they want to bring in their giant fishing fleets, which at a minimum are basically like vacuum cleaners and destroy the ecology of the ocean, just sort of leave it stripped bare. So there's all sorts of levels on which we really ought to be very, very concerned about the Chinese establishing footholds and expanding their presence in the Bahamas. But specifically, we were talking about at end is that the U.S. Navy happens to have out in the Bahamas something called the Atlantic Undersea Test and Evaluation Center, or AUTEC. And essentially, there is a long sandy bottom trench in the Bahamas, which is sort of cut off largely from the rest of the Atlantic Ocean. And this is an area where the United States Navy conducts some of the most sensitive testing that they do and conducts exercises. And
this is underwater testing, of course, involving submarines and their equipment. Right.
So, I mean, essentially, this is all involving the U.S. Navy submarine fleet. And the name of the game in submarine operations is remaining silent and undetectable. If you can be heard, you're dead. There's no such thing as surviving a torpedo strike. So it is all about disappearing into the ocean. And therefore, an attack submarine that's getting ready to deploy or at various other stages goes out here to AUTEC and is tuned up and evaluated in all kinds of ways that we can't discuss on the air to make sure that it can go out and, well, confront the Chinese and, if necessary, in a shooting war, remain undetected and we win and they lose. So what you have is the Chinese now establishing a presence on an island in the Bahamas, which is right at the entrance, the northern entrance to this trench in which all of this testing has been done. And what they want to do is they want to locate what they call their fishing fleet there. But of course, their fishing fleet is not a private enterprise. I mean, it's horrible as what they do to the ecology. That's not the sum total of what they do. It conducts all sorts of paramilitary activities. Many of these boats are armed, and also many of these vessels are spies. I mean, they are spy ships.
Intelligence vessels.
All over the world. Yeah, and it's not conjecture, and it's been documented for many years, and there's all sorts of photos of these guys. So in other words, once you put a commercial fishing fleet run by the CCP on this island, which will then have every excuse in the world, what we would call in the business cover, for floating around in the middle of what amounts to the U.S. Navy's Area 51, where they conduct their most sensitive testing of U.S. technology. And yet the Chinese miraculously have chosen an island right at the entrance to this area as the place where they just got to put a base for their fishing fleet.
Sam, we are out of time, I'm afraid. This is a topic to which I hope we can return soon. Obviously, the question arises, what do we do about this? I know you've given some thought to it. I commend our listeners to your piece at endmagazine.com for some preliminary discussion about it, but we'll have you back very soon to explain not just what the stakes of all of this are for our country, for our security, for our ability to deter aggression by the Chinese, if necessary to defeat it, but also how we are going to have to remedy a very mortal threat to all of that. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your great service to our country, my friend. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we will speak with Gordon Chang about the G7 summit right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and welcome especially to another of our featured guests here at Secure Freedom Radio, a regular by the name of Gordon Chang. He is one of our country's duty experts on China and our interests in the Western Pacific and beyond. He is, of course, the author of The Coming Collapse of China, a prolific contributor to the public policy debate at the Gatestone Institute and at Newsweek, and a man who I urge you to follow, as I do, at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. He is one of the high points of our week when we get the chance to visit with him, and this is that time. Gordon, good to have you back. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Frank.
I was just talking with Charles Faddis about Eric Swalwell and the concern that he has as a former clandestine services officer of the Central Intelligence Agency, who for a long time made his living running spies for the United States, namely a concern that Eric Swalwell may well still be being run by the Chinese Communist Party's security apparatus. This is an issue that is of grave concern, of course, because he continues to have access to the secrets that are available to members of the House Intelligence Committee, on which he continues to serve. What are your thoughts about all this, Gordon?
Yeah, Eric Swalwell should not be on the House Intelligence Committee. And indeed, I believe that the FBI and others should be investigating him. And the reason is not because we know that he was targeted by China's Ministry of State Security. If that were the case, and if that were the test, there'd be no members of Congress, nobody in the Senate, there'd be nobody in the White House. But the point is that Swalwell has not been willing to talk about this with the American public. And because of that, there is a substantial chance that he is hiding something. And therefore, because of that, because of Swalwell's inability to discuss this, then I believe that he should not be sitting on the House Intel Committee. And it means that Speaker Pelosi should not have kept him there, which means that her conduct should also be investigated. This goes to a much broader question. We know that China has been overwhelming the FBI and others, and then many Americans have been compromised, and we need to have a much more resolute attitude on this. Speaker Pelosi's view is really disgraceful and I think a risk to the United States.
Amen to that. Just to be clear, not every member of Congress has succumbed to the temptations of the Ministry of State Security, sleeping with their spies and so on. I don't think you mean to suggest that, but they all have been targeted, that's for sure. And we do need to know who have, in fact, in some form or fashion, been compromised. I think that's beyond dispute.
Yes, everyone has been targeted. And that's why I say that's not the test of this. What the test is, whether members of Congress and others are willing to speak plainly about it when there does appear to be an issue. We know that Christine Fong, was suspected as a Ministry of State Security agent. We know the FBI informed Swalwell. We know that his family, Swalwell's family, has remained in contact with Fong Fong up until a few months ago. This is extremely suspicious. And the thing that really bothers me is that Swalwell will not talk to the public about it. If Swalwell were to say, for instance, yeah, I slept with her, so what? That would seem to me to indicate a state of mind where he did not feel sensitive about it. But he has assiduously avoided any contact with the press about this, running away from the press in some circumstances. That really indicates a guilty state of mind.
Yeah. Well, and possibly, and this is Sam's point, continuing compromise that could be, again, very perilous to our country. Let me turn to a different topic with you, Gordon, related to China, of course, but the G7 meeting, which has just concluded, did feature China this time around. It had been observed that the participants in these meetings have declined to talk about China, in at least their communiques of the past few years. What did you make of the conversation that seems to have taken place and the upshot with respect to China and its abuse of human rights?
Well, President Biden, to his credit, raised this issue and pressed other members of the G7. He didn't get as far as everyone would have liked, certainly not as far as he wanted. But he did make some progress. The real issue is going to be at the NATO ministerial, which follows. And that really is going to be important because what the G7 failed to do, I think that NATO has a chance to start to talk about China in a more resolute way. It's been reported that NATO will not list China as an adversary, which is a mistake, especially because China calls members of NATO enemies. But nonetheless, this puts pressure on Beijing. We know that Beijing a few hours ago went berserk about the G7 communique, even though it wasn't as strong as it needed to be. This is a process. One other thing, though, Frank, and that is we don't necessarily need to see G7 communiques of the type that we would like. And the reason is China's doing itself in Europe. Last month was a very bad. And one of the things that is possible is that we keep pressing. We may not get where we want to, but China will, I think, poison the relationships it has remaining in Europe. And that'll be a good dynamic for us. But obviously, you know, China is right now at a very strong point in Europe. Europe is closer to China than it is to the United States, with the exception, of course, of Britain and some of the countries in Eastern Europe.
Well, this is the concern that I have, Gordon. I certainly hope you're right that it's hit a rough patch and that we'll continue to head in that direction. But I've been looking at the penetration of Europe with China's Belt and Road Initiative, as it's called, and Huawei sort of digital infrastructure building. And it does seem as though they're continuing, despite some buffeting, notably on human rights issues, to make inroads and to gain a degree of influence that is very ominous for NATO and I think for the United States as well, which, of course, is among the preeminent enemies that they are characterizing as such. Let me ask you, Gordon, if I could, about something you've written on that I think is very interesting, and that is the degree to which we are suffering in the form of illegal immigration, in part due to China's policies that have grievously affected some of the countries from which this illegal immigration is emanating, namely the Northern Triangle. Talk a little bit about the thesis of that piece that you had at The Hill last week.
Well, the Northern Triangle countries were destabilized for many reasons, but one of them is that factories left there when China joined the World Trade Organization when it acceded in 2001. And one of the ways to solve this, because Vice President Harris always talks about root cause, the root cause is not going to be solved by throwing aid at the Northern Triangle, which is what she's been doing, because we do not need to enrich corrupt elites there. This doesn't serve American interests, doesn't serve the interests of those countries. What would serve the interests of those countries if manufacturing came back to there, because that would stabilize those societies. And once those societies were stabilized, people wouldn't be leaving and pressing our southern border. So I think that we should be working very hard to bring manufacturing there, which we can for a number of reasons. Remember, we don't have at this moment very many migrants from Mexico trying to come into the U.S. And the reason is because of the USMCA agreement, which is the successor to NAFTA. Mexico has enormous problems, but it's moving towards prosperity because of trade. We should be doing the same thing with the three Northern Triangle countries.
Well, it's an interesting question about Mexico. I have the feeling this is a work in progress, but I take your point, and it certainly seemed in the course of the conversations that in Kamala Harris's visit to Guatemala and Mexico was urged by their leaders to give a trade emphasis to the help to their countries rather than an aid emphasis. And you might just develop a little bit, Gordon, why that is so important, given the past experience we've had with aid to such countries.
Well, aid has really gone to elites there, and they've got extraordinarily wealthy leaders. And part of the problems in places like Guatemala is because you do have aid being misused, and that certainly is corrosive. If you were to have factories there, you'd have people getting jobs. You'd have other people being able to service the factory workers. You generally bring prosperity. And the other thing is, and President Biden should be focusing on this. I mean, he believes climate change is the number one threat to the United States. Well, part of the reason why we have more carbon in the air is because of those huge container ships. People say that 15 of the largest container ships put as much carbon into the air as all of the cars in the world. So if we were to have our goods manufactured in the Northern Triangle in Central America, that would eliminate that Pacific or substantially reduce that Pacific trade, which means we'd be having a cleaner environment. I know global warming, climate change, very controversial, but I don't think anyone's really in favor of putting more carbon in the air. And so clearly Biden can kill about three or four birds with one stone if he were to try to put more manufacturing into the Northern Triangle, into Central America, into the Caribbean. This would be a great win for the United States.
Very important points. Gordon Chang, as always, we appreciate the clarity with which you perceive these problems and describe them to the rest of us, and the solutions that I think you commendably persist in bringing forward, so that you're not just raising an alarm, you're offering suggestions as to what can be done about the problem. Thanks for doing it on this program, faithfully, week after week. We look forward to talking with you again next week, Gordon. In the meantime, stay well and keep up the terrific work you do at Newsweek and the Gatestone Institute and elsewhere. And come back to us soon. Next up, we will speak with Elaine Donnelly about the assault on our military in the form of, well, social engineering, critical race theory, and more, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and it's always a pleasure to say we're being joined by one of the most consequential people I know when it comes to matters involving the social contract and character of the United States military, and little understood but very real factor in the good order and discipline and the integrity and the readiness of our armed forces. This is something that I think many in the military are certainly familiar with, but relatively few civilians. And one of those civilians who does get it and has worked tirelessly on it for decades, notably through her extraordinarily important organization, the Center for Military Readiness, is Elaine Donnelly. She has served on both departmental and presidential commissions on related subjects, and she is one of our go-to people when it appears as though a concerted effort is being made, as is the case now, to fundamentally transform our military, to use the phrase Barack Obama coined. And I'm anxious to catch up with her, particularly in light of some very important conversations that are now taking place, notably between Senator Tom Cotton and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, about something called critical race theory in the United States military. Elaine Donnelly, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It is so good to have you with us.
Thank you for that very nice introduction, Frank. It's always good to talk to you.
Heartfelt and justified. Let me ask you about this exchange last week. Tom Cotton, of course, has served in uniform. He knows a lot about the kinds of things that you focus on. Describe this exchange and what light it shed on what is the current state of play in the military with respect to all this critical race business.
Well, as you said, I've been involved in military social issues for decades, but I have never seen the kind of intensity of controversy that we're seeing now with critical race theory instructions in the military. And it was very encouraging to see a United States Senator Tom Cotton be prepared to confront the Secretary of Defense, who is one of the primary advocates of critical race theory in the military, questioning him so skillfully. He actually got the Secretary of Defense to agree with him that critical race theory, or CRT, has no place in our military. It wasn't easy. He tried to, you know, kind of dance around the question and say, well, it's not a simple yes or no. Well, it is a yes or no. Should we be teaching our military personnel that America is a terrible country? The answer is no. Should we be teaching people in the military that people should be judged by the color of their skin? The answer is no. And yet, he had difficulty answering it in a short version. He eventually got there. But it was due to the fact that Senator Cotton confronted him with statements that he had gathered through a website for whistleblowers. Now, let's talk about the whistleblowers. These are people in the military. They have no way to go up the chain of command. But these people, now that they have a venue, they can go to Senator Cotton or Dan Crenshaw on the House side and describe what is happening in the classroom. Now, imagine being in a classroom and you're a white person, and you are being told that you are the cause of racism, that you are racist. And if you deny that you're racist, that proves you're racist. And across from you in the room is a person of a minority race, and you're going to be leading that person, or that person is going to be leading you into combat. It is cultural dissonance. It is toxic. It is so divisive.
Well, it's been described actually as cultural Marxism.
Yes, it is Marxism.
Designed to destroy that unit cohesion and the confidence in your brothers and sisters in arms that's vital, as you know so well.
That's right. I never felt a need to really study the roots of Marxism. A book has been, actually several books written about Marxism. The essence of it is to divide people into oppressors and victims. So you're either on one side or the other. The classic Marxists in Europe, they tried to have class warfare, the bourgeoisie versus the proletariat, things like that. Now the division is based on race, and it is pervasive. Once you become aware of it, you see it creeping into all sorts of instructions. Sometimes it's called diversity and inclusion. And there's nothing wrong, really, with teaching people to be to treat people with respect and non-discrimination, recognition of individual merit. We're all for that. Secretary of Defense said, yes, we're all for that. But when you distort that to say that one class of people, based on their skin, is known to be and is proven to be an oppressor class of others who are the oppressed. Once you go down that road, it's completely different. It's completely different than what Harry Truman, the president, signed into law with his executive order, I think it was 1948. Non-discrimination, recognition of individual merit. That's what our military has been all about. Now, people are trying to change that, and it's wrong.
One of the books that I would commend to our listeners that I think you're alluding to is a new book written by one military officer who has had the courage to stand up against all of this craziness, Lieutenant Colonel Matthew Lohmeyer. It's entitled Irresistible Revolution, Marxism's Goal of Conquest and the Unmaking of the American Military.
Reading the book right now, and it does give the historical roots of where this philosophy comes from.
And one of the things that you've done so brilliantly for so long, Elaine Donnelly, at the Center for Military Readiness, which is CMRlink.org, where I really encourage people to go for more information on what's afoot here, is you've been warning about how these various efforts to assault kind of the character of the military, the culture of the military, whether it's, you know, this critical race, you know, indoctrination, is incompatible with the good order and discipline that our military requires if it is to be effective. And what is so worrying to me, and I know to you too, is this is happening at a time when enemies of this country seem to be increasingly emboldened and dangerous. And the last thing we should be doing to the only military we have is to be weakening it in the face of the enemy and further intensifying their expectation, perhaps, that they can take us on and take us down with impunity. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, that's right. And Frank, you've been involved in these battles for how many years and decades as well. There are some positive signs, however. Senator Tom Cotton and Representative Dan Bishop are co-sponsoring, or they have separate versions of the same bill. It's called Combating Racist Training in the Military Act. It's called Senate 968 on the Senate side, H.R. 3134. People who are concerned about this should get in touch with their member of Congress and say, you need to co-sponsor with either the Senate bill or the House bill or both. You need to be a co-sponsor so that we can at least have legislation so that those whistleblowers who have no power right now, all they can do is try to tell the truth, so that the officials in the military who want to get rid of this stuff, who have no support right now under the current administration, Congress needs to act. Sometimes an act of Congress is the only way to go. And this is one of those times. There has to be a statement of principle comparable to what President Trump tried to do and did do at the end of his administration with an executive order. The incoming administration wiped out that executive order and said, we will have CRT in the military and all the other government agencies. We have to push back, and it will take an act of Congress.
One other thing that I would commend to our listeners, Elaine, and to you and your network, is a petition that is now online at Committee to Support and Defend. It is an effort to help military retirees and veterans and civilians as well, for that matter, to weigh in on this, to urge Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense, to honor the oath that he has now taken repeatedly, and so many others of us have had to take over the years, not had to take, but have taken voluntarily, whether it's as military personnel or as civilians in government, to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And it's absolutely vital that he be called out on this, because I'm afraid that whether he means to or not, he is actually supporting and defending the revolution, the Marxist revolution that is trying to take down not just our military, unfortunately, but our country more generally. Elaine, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but this has been a very bracing conversation. I hope you'll come back to us with more time, because we really need to get into all of this in greater detail. Thank you for your time, though, today. Thank you to the rest of you for listening, and I hope you'll do so again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
Been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.